Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm a Senior Research Fellow at the Institute. I'm today joined by Jack Sharples, Research Fellow at the OIS, to discuss the paper LNG Supply Chains and the Development of LNG as a Shipping Fuel in Northeastern Europe. It was published, what was it, last week, Jack?
Yes, it was.
Yes, well, congratulations, I guess, your first paper for the OIS. So it's excellent.
Thank you.
Brilliant. Well, nice to have you here, Jack. But hang on, let's talk about the paper in more detail. So your paper specifically focuses on the take-up of LNG as a marine shipping fuel in the North Sea/Baltic Sea emission area. Before we start, could we just kind of address the higher level of issue of what are the advantages of LNG over other transportation fuels?
Yeah, of course. Okay, so very, very glad to be here talking to you. But what really catalysed this research is the forthcoming change in limits on sulfur emissions from shipping. That will take place from January 2020.
Right.
That's a global limit under the aegis of the International Maritime Organization. So the primary benefit of LNG here is that it contains virtually no sulfur compared to oil-based shipping fuels.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been the catalyst.
Right.
For this research.
But is it just a matter of emissions, sulfur emission? You know, what about nitrogen and particulate emissions?
Sure. Well, so we have obviously the global sulfur cap that's due to change.
Right. And that's gone down to what? Is it 0.5?
It was previously 3.5%,
right.
And it's coming down to 0.5%.
Understand.
And that refers to the sulfur content of the exhaust gases from each vessel.
Understand. Okay.
So that's sulfur. In terms of nitrogen oxides, NOx, you're quite right. The IMO actually has global limits on emissions of nitrogen oxides.
Mm-hmm.
With significantly more stringent limits applying within particular emissions control areas, of which the Baltic Sea and North Sea is one, North America and the US Caribbean is another. So that's nitrogen oxide. So there are global limits there as well. And again, the benefit of LNG is that LNG contains approximately 1/10 of the NOx of oil-based shipping fuels.
Oh, interesting. But okay, but if it's that good, you know, is LNG as a marine fuel economic versus its alternatives, or is there an extra cost of using LNG?
The fuel itself is very competitive.
Right.
So over the last couple of years, what we've seen is the price of LNG in Northern Europe being pretty much comparable to heavy fuel oil, which
mm-hmm.
is the base, most popular fuel for shipping, and trading at about $200 per ton discount to marine gas oil, which is a middle distillate fuel. It's low sulfur. It's what's predominantly used in the sulfur emissions control areas of Northern Europe and North America. So the fuel itself is very competitive. The difficulty is the capital cost of retrofitting existing vessels to run on LNG.
Yeah.
Now, that's quite expensive. And obviously the calculations of that depend on the size of the vessel, how much fuel you consume, the spreads between different fuels, and then shippers will calculate how long it takes to pay back.
Yeah.
So that's what's stopping owners of existing vessels plumping for LNG.
Well, I'm sure we'll address that later on in our podcast today. But just before we move on to kind of look at this in more detail, you know, what about other low sulfur fuels such as gas oil, even low sulfur fuel oil? Because, you know, is the oil industry just going to sit back and let LNG take all its business?
Oh, absolutely not. This is the major issue facing the global oil industry.
Right.
Because at the moment, heavy fuel oil, which is predominantly consumed in shipping, it's a residual fuel. It's basically the cheap stuff left over at the bottom of the barrel after you've refined a barrel of oil. Now, up to now, the global shipping market has acted as a sort of sink for that residual fuel. It's where they sell it off cheaply. In terms of how the oil industry is going to cope post-2020, we're going to see a greater demand for middle distillate fuels,
mm-hmm.
low-sulfur marine gas oil, which, by the way, if it has a sulfur content of 0.1% or lower,
mm-hmm.
Is usable not only at the global level, but within the sulfur emissions control areas, which have lower sulfur caps than the rest of the world. So obviously greater demand for middle distillates, but also the oil majors are working on blending some of their low sulfur middle distillates into their fuel oil to create these, they're called very low sulfur fuel oil blends, which will meet this 0.5%.
But they'll be more costly, I would imagine.
They will indeed. Yeah. The early indications are, in fact, that they will trade at just a slight discount to low sulfur marine gas oil.
Okay.
So they represent, for existing ship owners, a zero capital but higher operational cost option. For them, it's a wait and see option,
really.
They'll take the hit in the short term in terms of higher fuel costs, but at least they'll hold off making their decisions on CapEx.
Interesting. Well, why don't we kind of narrow down a bit on Europe now? And, you know, was Northeastern Europe the first emission control area, and what has happened?
Sure. It was the first emissions control area, the Baltic Sea from 2006 and the North Sea from 2007. So at the time, an initial sulfur cap was introduced. It was then tightened in 2010 and tightened again in 2015. So we've seen really a stepwise approach in Northern Europe to limiting sulfur emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And that really foreshadows what has happened at a global level, where limits on sulfur emissions were first introduced in 2005 and then tightened in 2012, and then they're going to be tightened again in 2020.
Yes.
So in that regard, Northern Europe is an excellent case study.
Yeah, which is why I think your excellent paper kind of sets some lessons learned which can apply globally. But obviously LNG needs quite a lot of infrastructure. So, you know, how have the energy supply chains been developed, and, you know, how long has it taken? You know, were they built solely around LNG for bunkers?
Absolutely not. absolutely not.
Bunkers have been the beneficiary then?
Bunkers have definitely been the beneficiary here. This is something that has developed largely within the last decade.
Right.
And it's developed on the basis of the creation of a regional LNG market in Northern Europe.
Right.
If you were to cycle back to 2010,
mm-hmm.
you would see the only large-scale LNG import terminals in Northern Europe being Zeebrugge and Isle of Grain,
yep.
and then just outside the emissions control area, obviously Southhook and
Absolutely, yes.
Dragon.
Yeah.
Since then, we've
seen... They're in the UK, of course, Southhook and Dragon.
Yep. Yes.
Yep, that's it, right?
So what we've seen is the launch of Gate Rotterdam,
yep.
Klaipeda, Svinoujscie, and Dunkirk as large-scale import terminals.
Right.
In that same period since 2010, we've seen the launch of small-scale LNG terminals as well, small-scale import terminals in Sweden and in Finland.
So that's been based around what the domestic market...
That's based around the domestic
LNG
market.
LNG for power, LNG for gas?
I would imagine partly for power, but probably predominantly for industrial consumption.
Industrial, okay.
So
yes,
particularly if you look at the Finnish terminals, they're really for the provision of LNG for off-grid areas, but for industrial consumption.
So the infrastructure is built around a land-based market.
Absolutely. And what we've seen as well develop in the same period, or slightly foreshadowing in the 2000s, the development of Norwegian small-scale LNG exports.
Yeah.
So what you've got is this infrastructure in the region that was really built for land-based consumption of LNG,
mm-hmm.
That has then provided a basis on which you can add a little bit of extra infrastructure just to make that, to bridge that last mile between the terminals and actually loading the fuel onto ships.
That's interesting. Well, often this is a fundamental change that's taken place in this region. So often change like this takes a visionary company. You know, is there a particular company that's driven that change, or is it just done by several companies?
No, I would say that there are. There's one or two. So Gasnor in Norway was the first mover. So they... are the owner-operators of Norway's first two small-scale LNG export terminals.
Yeah.
But really, if you're looking for a true visionary in terms of completing a value change and chain and getting into bunkering, you've got to look at Scangas, which is now owned by Gazprom.
Yeah.
And there what you saw was them having ownership and operating control over Norway's largest small-scale LNG export terminal.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at a company that also actually owns small-scale LNG carrier vessels.
Right.
And they've built small-scale LNG import terminals in Sweden and Finland. And beyond that, they also own an LNG bunker vessel as well.
So they've gone right through the chain.
They've gone through the value chain. Essentially, they're a small company that have created an entire value chain.
That's interesting, you know. So it's a small company, but surprisingly, it's not specifically an infrastructure provider, a supplier or a buyer that's dominated the driving of the change. It's been somebody smaller across the whole chain.
It's a small, entrepreneurial, mm-hmm. nimble company that spotted a gap in the market, essentially. And it's no coincidence that this grew out of Norway.
Yeah.
We referred earlier to limits on NOx emissions. The Norwegian government actually imposed its own national limits on NOx emissions from shipping in 2007, and then from 2008 started providing subsidies for measures to reduce NOx.
So they set the regulator environment, and then Scangas reacted within that.
Absolutely, yes.
It is interesting whether regulation leads or company leads, isn't it?
In this case, it's absolutely regulatory led. So Norway was the trailblazer, if you like, with their national level regulations, and Norwegian companies reacting to that, and indeed on the consumer side, Norwegian ferry companies, operators of offshore platform supply vessels as well in Norway, taking up LNG as a fuel in response to these Norwegian national level regulations. And essentially they proved the technology. And then when we saw particularly the tightening of regional sulfur emissions limits in 2015, that you started to see other actors in the region start to react to this.
Well, let's kind of explore now a kind of the move out from the region. So your paper concludes, as you just said, that changes in regional environmental regulations have been a crucial catalyst for the uptake of LNG as a marine fuel in Northern Europe, and that, then you say, changes in the global environment regulations could incentivize the uptake of LNG as a marine fuel at a global level in regions beyond the current ECA. So I think my question is, how could that happen? How do you see that happening?
Sure. Well, you're absolutely right. The first point of departure is this shift in global environmental regulations from January 2020. In terms of how this could happen, we need to be looking at regions that already have substantial LNG infrastructure for other purposes.
Right.
Essentially a foundation upon which we can build this last mile. Then we're also looking at, as the availability of LNG as a bunker fuel spreads, we can look at the number of vessels that are on order to get an idea of where they're going to be operational, who's going to own and operate these vessels.
Right.
The data that we have at the moment suggests that the global fleet of LNG-fueled vessels is set to double between now and 2026, with the majority of those vessels actually due for delivery by the end of 2022.
But it's interesting, your conversation very much is kind of towards new vessels. You know, so now you say that, so basically you're insinuating that only new vessels will be designed with LNG propulsion systems. And, you know, what about retrofitting existing, you know, LNG propulsion systems? Why is that not happening?
Sure. Well, as I alluded to earlier, the greatest barrier here is the cost of capital investment and the payback times. If you're looking at meeting these sulfur emissions limits, then for an existing vessel, actually installing what is known as a scrubber, an exhaust gas cleaning system that removes the sulfur from your vessel's exhaust emissions, is cheaper and will allow you to continue burning high sulfur.
So we're going to see an increase in the use of scrubbers.
Oh, absolutely.
But what about the residue out of the scrubbers? Isn't there residue there?
That's the problem. The disposal of the sulfur that you extract from the exhaust gas emissions. There are already moves by various ports around the world and some national level regulations prohibiting the dumping of this so-called wash water into what are essentially close to shore areas.
Yeah.
So this will need to be dumped out at sea. Now, from an environmental perspective, this is disastrous.
Absolutely,
essentially.
Yeah.
If you there's little point in preventing the emission of sulfur through into the air through your exhaust
gases dumping it in the sea.
So that's, in a long-term perspective, surely not sustainable environmentally, but it's commercially attractive, particularly because the vast majority of vessels will try to operate probably using a 0.5% sulfur fuel oil blend.
Yeah.
That's where we're going to see the majority of the existing vessels going.
Yeah.
But of course, they're going to have to take on higher fuel costs there.
But under the regulations, can they even load 3.5% sulfur? They can't.
They can't load it unless they have a scrubber.
Right. Okay. But if they have a scrubber, they can.
If they have a scrubber, they can.
Right.
So what we're expecting is the non-compliant oil-based fuels will decline substantially in price, which will make scrubbers more attractive.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think what's going to be crucial for the LNG bunkering sector is the spread between the high sulfur non-compliant oil-based fuels, which, you know, if you invest in a scrubber, that's what you'll be consuming, to compare that with LNG. If the spread is not too great, then LNG will remain competitive and attractive. But I think it's absolutely clear that it will be an absolute minority of ship owners that choose to retrofit to LNG. But when it comes to ordering a new vessel, asking the manufacturer for an LNG propulsion system instead of an oil-based propulsion system is not that expensive when you compare it to the need to add a scrubber from the get-go, for example. But what's also relevant here is that from January 2021, new vessels in Northern Europe will be subject to much more stringent NOx emissions.
So there's even more limitations coming in the
absolutely,
future.
Absolutely.
It's a dilemma, isn't it, for a ship owner? Because a ship owner, you know, he has to make a decision today for a piece of kit that's going to last 25, 30, 40 years.
Absolutely.
And this level of uncertainty, you know, you don't want to back the wrong horse. Well, I found just an interesting conclusion of your analysis, so if I can jump to that, is that the demand for LNG as a shipping fuel is likely to rise at a steady pace rather than a sudden kind of big bang. If this is the case, then, you know, what are the incentives for companies to build new LNG bunkering infrastructure now? Because, you know, they're not going to have the big bang growth. Why should they be building bunker barges? Why should they be arranging for, you know, locations to supply bunkers?
Sure. Well, I think the positive case here is that the growth is predictable.
Okay.
It's predictable in the sense that if we accept the argument that the majority of consumption of LNG as a shipping fuel will be by new vessels, then you can estimate quite accurately the future growth by looking at the vessels on order.
Right.
Because obviously it takes a long time to build a new vessel. Yep. So if you have a database of the vessels that are currently on order, you can estimate the size of the vessel, how much fuel they're going to consume, how much essentially fuel consumption they're going to add to the global demand from X year in the future. So what we can see is that with the existing fleet of vessels, that fleet is going to double in number by 2022, and a few more by 2026. More will are being added constantly to the order book, but also the average size of those vessels is increasing.
Right.
So the actual demand for LNG will probably rise more quickly than a simple doubling between now and 2022. So the growth is predictable. In terms of the providers of LNG as a bunker fuel, the additional investment that they need to make is actually rather minimal.
Okay, all right.
So if you, say for example, at an LNG import terminal, large or small scale, if you add a simple truck loading facility, then LNG can be loaded onto a truck. That truck can then be driven to a port where it can be loaded straight onto a vessel.
Right.
Now, that's relatively small scale.
Yes.
If you want to move up the scale a little bit more, then you invest in a bunker vessel. So for that, you go to an LNG import terminal, you go to a small scale reloading jetty, and instead of loading the LNG onto a carrier vessel to move it around the market, you load it onto this bunker vessel. The bunker vessel can then go to a port.
But you've already mentioned, but you're then going to have to invest in a bunker vessel, and the terminal's going to have to invest in a small scale loading jetty. So there are investments involved, and they're only going to do that if they can be guaranteed to have them being used.
Absolutely. But what's important here is flexibility.
Yeah.
So the small scale reloading jetties that have been developed at the large scale terminals in Northern Europe were not developed and paid for off the back of bunkering.
They were
developed and paid for off the back of break bulk activities, where, for example, you import a large scale cargo from Qatar to Zeebrugge, and then you break it up into several smaller cargoes, send a bit to Klaipeda, send a bit to Nynäshamn in Sweden, send a bit to Tornio in Finland, and suddenly
that's a relatively new concept. You know, it's been the last 5 years, you know, in our business. Let me talk something, an interesting concept in your paper. Called building the last mile, which I found was quite interesting. Perhaps you could tell us a bit about that.
Sure, sure. Well, the quote is not mine.
good quote.
That's taken from an LNG industry expert.
Right.
But what I would say here is that if you already have your LNG terminals,
yep.
if you already have the small-scale reloading infrastructure that was built to service a small-scale regional LNG market as mm-hmm. we have in Northern Europe, then essentially the last mile is what you need to do to bridge that gap between the terminal and actually loading the LNG onto a vessel.
Mm-hmm.
At its smallest scale, that means loading it onto a truck and bunkering it that way.
Right.
At the mid-range, it means loading it onto a bunker vessel. At the greatest extent, it means investing in fixed infrastructure at an LNG terminal, such as a loading arm, like a fixed arm with a hose in it.
Mm.
But these are relatively small investments, really, compared to the value added that you're going to get from it, particularly when you know that there are X number of vessels on order, mm-hmm. that the demand is going to increase by this particular amount.
Mm-hmm.
So actually what we've seen is a very gradual stepwise development of this industry,
yes.
where the most limited investments came first, a small number of LNG fueled vessels entered the market.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then a little more infrastructure was developed, a little more, you know, a slightly higher number of vessels came into the market. Yeah. And it was very organic.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, the development of infrastructure didn't race ahead of the number of vessels
mm-hmm.
that were out there consuming LNG, mm-hmm. and likewise, ship owners were not racing ahead and ordering hundreds and hundreds of vessels to a region that didn't have the infrastructure to support it, that it was very much a symbiotic relationship, let's say.
Yeah.
And that really provides a degree of security for the market participants.
Which they've got to have, because it's huge investment. But there is this chicken and egg situation.
Oh,
I just want to jump, if I can, to the future, you know, and your paper notes that the International Maritime Organization in April 2018, the delegates set aspirational targets to reduce CO2 emissions from shipping by 40% by 2030 and by 70% by 2050, and amazingly, to reduce total greenhouse gas emissions by 50% by 2050 compared to 2008 levels. Is that vision achievable, do you think?
I would say that the 2030 target is achievable.
Mm-hmm.
If we look at the measures...
So that's the 40% target, yes?
Yes, right.
Yep.
If we're looking at the measures currently being implemented.
Mm.
Now, the International Maritime Organization already has its own measures for energy efficiency standards for ship design and energy efficiency standards for ship operation.
Mm-hmm.
The idea being that those standards will be tightened every 5 years towards what eventually will be a 30% reduction in CO2 emissions by comparable ship class,
right,
by 2025.
Yeah.
Now, if you add on top of that the possibility of fuel switching to LNG, where you will reduce CO2 emissions by somewhere between 17.5% and 20%, as compared to heavy fuel oil or the middle distillate marine gas oil, then between those two, well, three measures really, the energy efficiency in design and operation and the fuel switching, that will get you beyond your 40%. The problem comes when we're aiming at this massive 70% reduction in CO2 emissions by 2050. And for that, I think we're going to have to think more radically.
That's pretty aspirational, isn't it?
That's pretty aspirational.
Exactly.
That's essentially saying that to the greatest extent, you're going to be removing hydrocarbons as a fuel source for shipping.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the in short sea shipping, then you're probably going to be looking at battery propulsion. Particularly battery propulsion, let's say, of small ferries operating on, you know, point to point.
So effectively using technologies we actually don't have today. So there's an assumption there that new technologies will actually materialise.
Absolutely. There are certain technologies that are gradually coming into play.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the very interesting ones is the use of rotor sails. So, you know, the very tall tubes that mm-hmm. you put on top of your vessel that reduces your fuel consumption, provides a little bit of extra propulsion. We've seen the first rollout in the last 12 months of that on a ferry and the first rollout of that on a cargo ship. So there are new and interesting ways to reduce fuel consumption.
Back to the days of sail, it sounds like to me. But, we're coming to the near end of our time. I'd just like to, you know, I always like to end up just asking for a little kind of conclusion. So, you know, we have covered a lot of subjects over the last 25 minutes, you know. So how's it going to end up? You know, what is going to happen, Jack, in your view?
Well, if we're looking specifically at the take-up of LNG as a shipping fuel,
mm-hmm.
As I mentioned earlier, I think the growth will be steady rather than spectacular.
Right.
We will be able to predict that growth by the number of vessels on order and the size of those vessels.
Mm.
I think that we're going to see total demand for LNG as a bunker fuel more than double by the early 2020s.
To what? What type of numbers are you talking about in 2025 or 2030? Have you got any numbers you can...
Yeah.
They're in your paper?
Sure. Yes, they are indeed in the paper. We're looking at, currently at a global level, about 2 BCM of natural gas. So
right.
about 1.5 million tonnes of LNG per year as current demand.
Today. Yeah.
Today.
Okay. Yeah.
I think we'll see that double by the early 2020s.
Right.
So let's say broad brush 5 BCM by 2025.
Which is not huge.
It's not huge, no.
But by 2030, then, will I expect a lot?
By 2030, it's harder to predict. Yeah. I think by the mid-2020s, we'll get a much better idea of how vessel owners are reacting to the January 2020 change in regulations. Mm. But if the growth continues, then you could be looking at 10 BCM by 2030. It's difficult to predict because we've seen the early growth in Northern Europe.
Yeah.
But where we're going to see the growth take off a bit more, we've let's say slightly less development in North America, and we're going to see, I think, quite substantial growth in China, then because we're at such an early stage, it's quite difficult to see where that's going to end up. I think 5 years from now, we'll have a much clearer idea.
Well, I must admit, from the energy market, energy business perspective, I hope you're wrong, because I'd like to see a greater uptake if I can. But anyway, Jack, look, thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed our conversation that builds on your paper, LNG Supply Chains and the Development of LNG as a Shipping Fuel in Northeastern Europe. And you can find that at our website, www.oxfordenergy.org, where you can also find all our podcasts in the multimedia folder and other papers published by the Institute. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, and thank you and goodbye to everyone.